Ron Pattinson joins me to talk about UK brewing during World War I. This is Beersmith Podcast number 201.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 201, and it's early October 2019. Ron Pattinson joins me this week to discuss beer brewing in the UK during World War I. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small places with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and wort clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Plus, it's fast and conveniently sized to help you save space and gain speed without compromising quality. With the optional Brew Commander, adds precise temperature control and mash automation. And with a BrewEasy, you'll discover definitive proof that size isn't everything. There are electric and propane models available. It also happens to be the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical beer brewing and runs a blog called Shut Up About Barclay Perkins at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Ron, it's a pleasure to have you on again.
Yeah, well, always fun to chat.
So how are things there in Amsterdam today?
Very rainy and wet. Actually, I got absolutely drenched coming home. But
we have a beautiful sunny day here in Virginia. But so what have you been working on since the last time we had you on? We last had you on to talk about World War II beer brewing, and I think today we're going to talk a little about World War I.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last book I published was my book on World War I, which is Armistice. At the moment, I'm really busy on my one about World War II that I'd like to have finished for next year, since it's the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. So I've been dead busy writing recipes for that at the moment. So I did a whole load of ones this week. So, and some very time-consuming research into brewing records, because I'm realizing how many of them I haven't processed yet, which is a bit frustrating. means it's lots of work. But yeah, then I end up with all these tables of stuff that are of no interest to anyone but me. So yeah, it's sort of worth it.
So Ron, we're going to talk a little bit about your new book, of course, is Armistice, which covers the World War I period and the years after it, actually. But before we do that, I thought it would be important to talk about the state of UK brewing before the war, because I think you found some surprises there, right?
I was surprised at what a bad state it was in. The last couple of decades of the 19th century, the 1880s and 1890s, had been really good for British brewing. Beer consumption was going up, making lots of money. It was a really, really good time. And they took advantage of this, lots of them, by going public. And then they got all these funds in, large amounts of cash. And what most of them used it for was to buy pubs. Because the results of the 1869 Licensing Act had been that basically the number of pubs was really restricted, wasn't really going to go up.
So they basically limited the number of licenses you could have for pubs, right?
Yeah, and because the vast majority of beer was sold in pubs, something like 90%, if you didn't have access to pubs, you weren't going to sell any beer. And so people just started buying up like crazy.
So this is where the breweries took over a lot of the pubs and created these public houses, right? Which we don't have here in the U.S. really.
Well, you used to have it in the U.S.
Yeah.
I've seen buildings in Chicago that still have the Schlitz signs on them that were old Schlitz tied houses before Prohibition.
Sure.
It was outlawed by Prohibition, but in some parts of the U.S. you had it as well. Mm-hmm. Where directly owned public bars, but public houses in Britain. But then what you had happen in the early years of the 20th century is you get a new liberal government that comes in, wants to start all these social schemes, needs money for it. And because a lot of the people are these sort of like religious temperance people, one of the things they do is they tax breweries and pubs more. And so they massively increase the license duty on pubs. So it makes pubs less profitable, makes them worth a lot less money. Large breweries get into financial trouble. Allsops, one of the big Burton IPA brewers, actually goes into receivership in 1911. So loads of the breweries have to down their share capital because the value of their assets has gone down so much. So basically, when World War One breaks out, British brewing is in crisis, and very few people are making any money. People aren't paying any dividends. So it's really bad news. And surprisingly, the war, even though they have loads and loads of restrictions on what they can do, is actually great news for brewers because their profits come back. And most breweries end up the war in way better financial condition than they started it.
So it's a combination of this temperance, the raised taxes, and then the temperance movement, the increase in taxes and everything, left a lot of them in a very weak state, though, at the break of war in 1914, right?
Yes. And then the war, it's good for them. They can sell all the beer they produce. They might be restricted to how much they can produce, but they're still making really good profits. And I've got some figures on it. Some of it's in the book. And you can see some of the breweries, their profits, you know, they've been paying like no dividend for 5 years. And then suddenly during World War One, they're paying 20% dividends again all of a sudden because they're making so much money.
Wow. And prior to the war, where were they sourcing a lot of their ingredients? Because I know that comes into play throughout the book, right?
Well, basically what you had in Britain was after about 1840, Britain had too large a population that was drinking too much beer for British agriculture to be able to serve it. And so from 1840 onwards, basically, you see loads of foreign barley and loads of foreign hops. One of the things I often quote to people is about the 1860s, where during the period of the Civil War, something like 25 to 30% of all the hops being used in Britain were American. The US was exporting massive quantities. That carried on right up until World War One. People were using really large quantities of American hops because they were cheap.
And they were grown, a lot of them were grown up in New England, New York, and areas like that, right?
Originally, by the time you get into the 20th century, it's all the West Coast. Yeah. So in the brewing records, they're normally described, but they're described variously as Pacifics, Oregon, California. And sometimes British Columbia.
And so once the war starts, of course, the supply of ingredients changes pretty dramatically, right?
Yes. Initially not so much because they've still got supplies of hops. So in the first couple of years, you still see quite a lot of American hops being used. But then after about 1916, then you don't see them anymore. What is interesting is that you see Belgian hops being used right through the war. And the reason why you see Belgian hops being used right through the war is because the only bit of Belgium that wasn't occupied by the Germans is where the hop fields are. And so basically you still had the Belgian hop fields in operation, even though there were virtually no breweries left. So they obviously had hops over. So you see Belgian hops from 1915, 1916, 1917 harvest turning up in British beer during the war, when you don't see any other foreign hops because no other foreign hops are being imported.
So how did they deal with the fact that the U-boats were cutting off a lot of the ingredient supplies?
It was only a big deal, really, from 1917 onwards. So up until then, you hadn't seen much change in British beer. So, I mean, you'd seen some of the weaker beers had been knocked down a bit. So the milds, you know, a London mild might have gone down from 5% alcohol to 4.75% alcohol, but it wasn't a huge change.
Yeah.
When you see the really big changes after 1917, when you have the unlimited U-boat campaign, I mean, the thing that put the Americans into the war, when the Germans are just sinking everything. And it has a really big effect on the food supply in the UK. So up until then, it hadn't been that bad. The Germans hadn't really completely disrupted the food supply. There'd been a few shortages here and there, but generally people could cope. But in the beginning of 1917, it gets really bad. And you get to a point where there's only a couple of weeks of grain supplies left in the UK. And that's when the government steps in and has these really draconian rules about brewing.
Let's talk a little about some of the ingredient impacts that, you know, when the government starts restricting things here.
You have various things. So I mean, one of them is that a typical beer before World War I would have been brewed from pale malt, sugar, and flake corn. That was typical. What you have during the war is that that corn becomes pretty much unavailable because it wasn't grown in Britain at the time. So it's something only imported. So what you see is some breweries where the beers go back to being all malt and sugar, where they're not using adjuncts anymore. Mm-hmm. Basically just because they can't get hold of them. And you also see reductions sometimes in the amount of sugar being used, because again, some sugar was diverted for food production, so the amount that brewers could get was limited. So you see them messing around with their ingredients. You can see them sometimes obviously using up the old stuff that they've got. You see very strange recipes that have got where they're basically just using the malts that they have, where it's not the recipe they would normally have brewed.
So as the war progressed, I understand there were also restrictions actually put on brewing itself, right? Things like the quantity to brew, the gravity, and so on?
Yes. So you had restrictions on the quantity you could brew. So it was basically like a percentage of what the pre-war level had been. So by the end of the war, it was down to about a third of what the level had been.
So the brewing was cut by a third?
Well,
cut to a third?
Okay. What you have to realize is that all the restrictions refer to standard barrels.
Mm-hmm.
So a standard barrel was a tax concept. So a standard barrel was 36 imperial gallons at an original gravity of 1055.
Okay, and then I assume the tax went up and down based on the alcohol content or something like that?
No. It was a pro rata based on the gravity.
Oh, okay.
If you brewed a beer, so at the start of the war, the tax on a standard barrel was 7 shillings and 9 pence. If you brewed a beer twice as strong as that with twice as gravity, you paid twice as much tax. So it was a sliding scale. Basically, the stronger it was, the more money you had to pay.
And I believe that tax went up pretty significantly during the war, right?
Yes. I mean, it ended up at, I think, 80 shillings and then 100 shillings a bit after the war. So a huge increase, more than
from 7 to 100 is pretty significant.
Yeah. Where was that? We're talking about the So when you're looking at production, the limits on production were around standard barrels.
Okay.
So at the end of the war, the production in standard barrels was a third of what it had been at the start of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But because the beer was much weaker, the actual quality of beer wasn't a third of what it had been before. It was more like about 50 or 60%.
Interesting. So, they reacted to all these government actions by cutting the alcohol content, right?
No, they were told to.
Ah, okay.
So when you get to the end of the war, so first you get these things saying, that you have to brew a certain percentage of beer no stronger than 10.36. Then there were restrictions on what the original gravity could be of all the beer you brewed. The last one was in, I think, 1919. All the beer you brewed in the brewery couldn't average out to more than 10.30. So 3% ABV about.
So that's, and those are all original gravities, right?
Yeah. But I mean, what you also had at the end of the war were that you had price controls. So you had a beer in this gravity, had a maximum retail price of this. And so you had all these bands and those prices, the ones at the end of the war, basically determined what British beer was like in the whole interwar period. They stuck to those bands and those prices that they had at the end of the First World War. It's really interesting process. And you had really rigid price bands. So that, you know, in the 1920s, if you had a mild that was 6 pence a pint, you knew that was going to be about 4% alcohol because it was in the price, the gravity band that had been at the end of World War One. It's the reason why you see no draft beers stronger than about 10.55 after World War One. It's because that was the bottom end of the highest price brand. So when there'd been the price restrictions, it didn't make any sense to brew anything stronger. And people just got into the habit and stuck with that as being the highest strength of draft beer right up until World War II.
And so it's interesting too that those price bands were set at the retail level, right? So
yes. You know,
that in some cases they could squeeze profits out of the wholesale level.
Well, and one of the things that the publicans were very angry about was that exact thing, that there wasn't any restriction on the price that the brewery charged the publican. So there wasn't any restriction on wholesale prices, but there was on retail prices. But having said that, the publicans were still making loads of money. And they also did very well out of World War One. One of the reasons being that if you're a London publican, in 1914, you were opening 16 and a half hours a day.
Wow. And I'm trying to remember, I think there were restrictions on hours, at least during the war, right? How long did that last?
Till about 1988.
Wow. So how play that in. How does the, you know, we talk about, I mean, there's restrictions of all kinds here, but talk about the hours, for example.
Yeah, well, they started into start of World War One, London pubs opened from 6 in the morning till 12:30 at night.
Okay.
And then during the war, they really restricted the hours. So they basically knocked it down to something like 12 till 2 in the midday and then 6 till 9 at night. So basically about 5 hours.
So obviously you got to sell a lot of beer in 5 hours to make it worthwhile, right?
Yeah, but there was a shortage of beer anyway, so you could easily sell all of it.
Yeah.
And so for a publican, it was actually nicer because you didn't have to be, your work day was much shorter.
And tell us about, it's interesting too, so as all these restrictions are coming into play and you know you got limited stuff, how are they making so much more profit in this case? Because you mentioned the World War One actually got a number of the brewers healthy, right?
Because they were, even though there were all these restrictions, it still gave them plenty of room for profit.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the breweries were making such money. You had this thing in World War One where they had what was called an excess profits tax. Hmm. So to try and stop people profiteering from the war, if you made too much money, then they take some of it off you. And this happened to some of the breweries, that they were making so much money that they had to pay this excess profit tax.
Interesting. Well, we also see an interesting product pop up called Government Ale around 1917. What is that?
Well, Government Ale, that's a thing that was one of the first set of restrictions. So the basically one of the things the government said was you had to produce a beer that was, I think initially no stronger than 10.36, sold at 4p a pint, and brewers were basically forced to this class of beer. In reaction, they called it government ale, which really upset the government. They didn't like it because it had a bad reputation of being watery beer, so they didn't want it to be associated with watery beer.
But I think you were saying, was it 50% of the production was had to be government ale or something like that?
Yeah. And so at a certain point they said, you're not allowed to call it government ale because they didn't like it. But in the brewing records, it's quite often still called GA, right the way through, GA. Even after they couldn't actually sell it as government ale, it's still listed as that.
Interesting.
It was normally mild, though I have seen ones from other breweries outside London where it was a bitter rather than a mild. But normally in London, it was a mild because that was the most popular beer.
And then you mentioned this earlier, but I want you to maybe go in a little more detail. The war ends, obviously, in 1918, but many of the restrictions are in place all the way up until World War II. And how does that, like the standard barrel tax, of course, never actually goes down. How does that affect brewing through the interwar years?
One of the interesting things in the interwar years is seeing brewers get the hang of brewing lower gravity beer. And so what you see a lot in the 20s and 30s is a lot of complaints about the quality of draft beer. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems is that before World War One, when most of the beer was over 5% alcohol, publicans could get away with necessarily looking after the beer that well, because it got enough alcohol in it that it wouldn't go off very quickly. When they start having this beer that's only like 3% alcohol, then they're struggling to get in good condition.
You can't just throw it in the cellar and leave it there for weeks anymore, right?
No. And so you see that there's this learning process that goes on between the wars where brewers get the hang of brewing lower gravity beers and publicans get the hang of actually looking after and serving these lower gravity beers. So it takes a while. So, because I always think, well, nowadays British brewers, they're some of the best in the world at producing beers of just 3.5% that actually have some flavor.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't learn to do that overnight. And you know that the interwar period is basically where brewers learned that skill.
Is this a fundamental style change then, for example? I mean, we talked about how the gravities got lowered, but it wasn't just the gravities getting lowered. Were people evolving in terms of what styles they drank during the war years?
Basically what you have happened is what happens in you had the same thing happened in World War II. So the breweries, when they're limited in the amount that they can brew, they tend to concentrate on the popular beer styles, so the ones that are profitable. So the marginal ones tend to get dropped. So what you see in World War II is that the London brewers who were brewing tiny quantities of porter drop it because it didn't really make any sense anymore. They probably would have carried on longer at the war for sentimental reasons, but they stopped. And so you see, it's the same in World War I, that breweries really trimmed down their ranges. And so by the end of the war, a lot of the London breweries aren't actually brewing anything porter anymore at the end of the war. They're only brewing stout, government ale, and bitter. So a really restricted range of beers, which they then expand again at the end of the war, but not all the beers come back. So, I mean, you can look at it's like Whitbread, who before the war, they had two really strong stouts. They had SS and SSS, which were like 8 and 10% alcohol. Those beers never came back after the war.
Probably too expensive to make, right?
I don't know. They just never brought back those beers. Some of the other London breweries continued to brew strong stouts, but Whitbread never brought theirs back. So you see that there's a real trimming down of breweries' beer ranges, and that there's the beers that are less profitable, less popular, they generally fall out. I mean, what you see happening in Scotland is mild pretty much completely disappears during World War One. So that after World War One, I mean, I've got virtually no examples of Scottish mild, a genuine Scottish mild, after World War One, apart from William Younger. And the reason I think William Younger's an exception is they had pubs in England. And so, and I'm pretty sure they had pubs in London at the time. So they would have needed a mild just to sell down there. But the other Scottish breweries, not a trend, not all just pale ales.
Interesting. And there was no big mass movement to lagers, though, as we saw maybe in other areas of the world.
Well, what you do say, it's another a really interesting document I came across, which is from Barclay Perkins, where they're analyzing these various lagers that have been brewed, what I would guess mostly experimentally, by British breweries during World War One. And Barclay Perkins themselves experimented brewing lagers and decoction mashing a mild, which is really weird. And the obvious reason is that even though lager wasn't a huge thing at the time, it was actually quite profitable. And so you could see, because the bulk of lager supplies before World War One came from either Germany or Austria, so they all fell away. And breweries saw during World War One, obviously some of them, an opportunity for brewing lager. And what you see with Barclay Perkins in particular is they experiment a bit during the war with brewing lager. And then in the early 20s, they build a lager brewery, get a Danish guy to run it, and start seriously brewing lager. And it was obviously because they saw a gap in the market from the disappearance of the imported lager. I mean, another thing you have to realize that in the center of there were several Bavarian beer halls in 1914. Mm-hmm. I mean, Spaten had a beer hall on Piccadilly Circus up until 1914.
And probably not after that, right?
Well, no, it was confiscated when the war broke out. But in the West End of London, there were several German beer halls selling German and Austrian lager. So it wasn't a completely unknown thing. And so there was a market for this, and especially in London, there was a market, which is why Barclay Perkins would have got interested in it. Mm-hmm.
But it didn't, it didn't take off like it did in some other area. I mean, here in the U.S., well, a little bit later, but you know, lager certainly dominated for many years.
Well, the problem was in Britain that in lots of places where lager took off really quickly, the beers that were there before lager were decent quality and not very good often. Yeah. Whereas in the UK, you had really good quality beers already. It was much harder for lager to break through because it was more expensive. So why, when you'd already got this good quality beer of a lager that was twice as expensive? It didn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, another interesting fact you mentioned in your book is, the population really had never seen any inflation. The 40 years or so leading up to World War One, there was virtually no inflation in their adult lives. And then all of a sudden, we have a huge change in prices over just a few years. How did that affect brewing?
I think it affected drinkers more than brewers.
Yeah.
Because it was a huge shock, and you read the stuff in newspaper articles, and people aren't happy. you know, that they're mild, that it's been 2 pence a pint since their granddad was in short trousers, is now suddenly costing 4 pence or 6 pence or 10 pence a pint. That's a huge change in a short period of time when prices have been so stable. It's one of the great things for me when I'm investigating 19th century brewing, but because the prices were so stable for such a long period of time, you can actually say, okay, if I see a beer of that price, I know what sort of strength it's going to be, because it didn't change. If I start looking at stuff post-World War II, it's much, much more difficult, especially when you go past 1960, because there's just so much inflation that if things are different from year to year. And I mean, I know what it's like when I was at university. I mean, the price of beer changed like 6 times in a year. So, yeah, it must have been weird for the people who've never known the price of beer go up to suddenly have it really shoot up in price.
Of course, the wages are also changing pretty dramatically during the war.
Yes, well, that's the other thing, that people were earning more money, and so they could afford to pay more. And that's why you have all the beer shortages and why you have all the, in the munitions areas where people were earning lots and lots of money, you start having all the restrictions. So, you know, you have the whole thing like the Carlisle State Scheme, where the idea is that you don't try and go for total prohibition, but you try and stop the things that you think are being the causing the most damage. So they stop selling small bottles of spirits. They don't sell spirits at all in the pubs on a Saturday. Other things, so they generally and make the pubs less drinking dens. I mean, it's a really interesting thing, the Carlisle State Scheme, which continued until 1972.
So that was, I'm sorry, the Carlisle, I believe that was a government-owned, right? Government-owned experiment. We were going to talk about that in a minute, but in some cases, the government actually took over certain breweries. I think this was near a munitions plant, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you had a huge munitions plant in Gretsch, which is just over the border from Carlisle. But a lot of the people lived or went to drink in Carlisle. So the government bought up all the breweries in the town. Three closed.
Of course, the munitions plant was government owned as well, right?
Yeah. So they bought the three breweries in Carlisle, closed two of them, left one open, bought all the pubs, closed quite a lot of them. Actually, but some of the other ones that they left open, they tried to really improve and make nicer places. But yeah, this went on. So it was state owned up until 72, 73.
Wow. So how did that work out with the state owning the breweries, the pubs, and everything else?
Well, the state made money out of every single year.
Yeah. Interesting.
And after the war, the beer was a penny cheaper in the Carlisle state owned pubs than it was in all the other pubs. And the government made money out of it. Every year they ran the scheme.
Interesting. And did they do that in other places too, or just in Carlisle?
They had something similar in Enfield in London, but that was, I don't think they owned the breweries there. I think they only took over the pubs, but that was shorter lived. I think there might have been one scheme somewhere else, but it was the Carlisle one that was the main one.
So one of the other interesting dynamics here, of course, is during the war, you've got a flood of women entering the workforce and some of them consuming beer too, right?
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite books. It's this book called 70 Rolling Years by Sidney Neville, who was this bloke who was in the British brewing industry from the 1880s to the 1950s. So he was really in it for 70 years. But during World War One, he was on the board of control. So he was one of the people looking at all the rules about licensing and stuff. And so he wrote a memoir, and it has some really interesting stories in it. And one of the ones is all these people coming down from the north and saying how terrible it is that women were going into the pubs now. And Sidney Neville, who came from London, was saying, well, this is just perfectly normal. Women have always been doing this in London. And these people weren't very happy with what he said. Oh, another great one is where they said, oh, where they're on about extending Sunday closing from Wales to this part of England next to it. And they said, oh, well, if it has a good effect on production, should we extend this to the whole of England? And then he also said, well, if it doesn't help production, then maybe we should extend Sunday to everywhere. And all the sort of religious temperance nutters really didn't like that. But his memoir is brilliant. But it was a big difference. So in London, it was perfectly normal for women to drink in pubs, whereas in the north, it wasn't so much. And World War I seems to have really changed that.
Interesting. And of course, you know, a large number of women entered the workforce, and many of them stayed in the workforce throughout the interwar years, right? To some degree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing was that suddenly you've got all these women who are earning good wages and are more independent than they'd been before. And that's probably why they were going into pubs. Well, also probably because there weren't the men that pestered them anymore, because they were all away at the war.
Well, we've kind of only scratched the surface here, but what were some of the long-term impacts of World War I on the entire UK brewing scene?
Knocked down beer strengths. Completely changed the way people drank because of the licensing laws, which I completely and utterly loathed when I was younger. I always thought they were completely illogical. And thankfully, they've done away with them. Stupid things like afternoon. But I mean, that really was the 1922 Licensing Act, which basically cemented all the emergency wartime measures, made them had opening times a little bit longer. But basically, that was the way pubs were run until the late 1980s in England.
So, I mean, that licensing law continued by and large all the way into the 80s?
Yeah. So, I mean, pubs had opened typically 11 till 3 in the afternoon and then half 5 till 11, something like that, in cities. Hmm. And that was it.
Interesting. Are there other impacts today that we see?
Generally lower gravity beer. That's one of the big impacts. If I look at it from completely the brewing side, then you'd say, in terms of ingredients, crystal malt is pretty much unknown in English before World War I. You only really see it after World War I start creeping in, and then you get it more after World War II when they knock down the gravities again. So, I mean, was assumed it's trying to make up for the lack of body as you drop the gravity.
So there were. So you're saying prior to World War I, there really wasn't much crystal malt usage?
Oh, yeah, there was loads of crystal malt used, but not in bitter.
Oh, I see.
It was exclusively used in mild and in porter and stout. You never saw it in bitter.
Did we see a repeat of many of these things in World War II? I mean, obviously, some of the restrictions were still in place, but did they try similar things when World War II kicked in?
Well, there's a big difference between World War I and World War II. But the difference with World War II is that, the UK is completely geared up from minute one, assuming that the war was going to last a long time and that there were going to be interruptions in food supplies. And so they prepared really well.
So some of the lessons carried over, I guess, from World War I.
No, the UK had really learned its lessons from World War I. So it went into food rationing, huge boost in barley production. UK barley production increased like tenfold during World War II. It was crazy. Massive increase. And so what you see in World War II is quite different. So in World War I, nothing much happened. So between 1914 and early 1917, basically beer strength stayed the same. You see foreign hops disappear a bit, but there's not that much. And then there's a dramatic changes between early 1917 and late 1919. So huge things changing the whole time. Mm-hmm. What you see happening in World War II is that there's a gradual change at the start of the war, but the gravities get knocked down until 1942 and then 1943 until the end of the war. things stay pretty much the same. They've obviously completely stabilized the ingredient situation. And then you actually have problems after it. So during World War II, whereas in World War I, standard barrel production ended up being a bit of what it had at the start. In World War II, standard barrel production stayed the same. Bulk barrel production actually increased.
So, again, cutting down gravities, I assume, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but the quantity of beer actually increased during World War II. But when you're looking at standard barrels, so that's basically saying the amount of alcohol you're producing, basically, from brewing, stayed the same. And it was only knocked down. It was only knocked down after the end. Then in 1946, they knocked it down to 90% because the situation actually got worse in Britain after the end of the war.
Interesting. Do you have any closing thoughts on your book on World War One?
Well, it's got lots of fun recipes in it. I can't remember.
I didn't try and dive into the whole section on recipes, but you've got a huge number of recipes from most of the breweries, right?
I think there's 300 odd recipes in there. That cover the whole war period. And one of the things I wanted to do with recipes was to have ones for the same beer over the course of the war, so you can see what happened to one specific beer, which will give you, I think, gives you a better idea than just an abstract thing about saying how beer in general changed. But if you can look at, see what happened to specific beers during the war and how the war had an effect on them, I think that's more fun.
Awesome. Do you want to give us one quick example, maybe?
Of how a beer changed.
Yeah.
Barclay Perkins Mild's a good one. I mean, that changed all over the place, and they started putting brown malt and amber malt into it during the war and all sorts of things. It actually got a much more interesting grist than it had at the start of the war at various points. Buy the book and look at the recipes yourselves.
And where can people find the book? It's called Armistice, obviously.
And they can find a link via my blog, or they can go to Lulu, where they can look for it.
Your blog, give the address for your blog again.
Yeah, it's, was it Barclay Perkins?
I think it's barclayperkins.blogspot.com that's what I have anyways.
That's probably right. I'm sure you're right. I don't normally type it in.
If you type in, if you type in shut up about Barclay Perkins, it'll pop right up at the top of Google right there.
Yeah. So. I mean, if anyone wants to buy my books, just type in Ron Pattinson and Lulu and books and it'll come up. I've got lots of really excellent ones about a whole lot of
historical topics. Yeah.
Yeah, and all with ridiculous numbers of recipes.
Awesome.
I just hit number 200 for my new book this week.
Wow, that's fantastic. I hit episode 200 with the podcast, so that was a big deal last show. This is going to be 201 now, so this will be, yeah. Ron, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
No problem. It's always nice to chat anyway, Brad.
A pleasure, as always, to have my guest, Mr. Ron Pattinson, on. Ron is the author of dozens of historical books, including the new book, Armistice, which we talked about today. His blog, as I mentioned a minute ago, you can look up pretty quickly by Googling Shut Up About Barclay Perkins. Thanks again, Ron. Appreciate you being here.
Okay, no problem.
A big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Easy. Brew big in small places with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the warp clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, New World pull hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from Beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.